Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Normandy Ellis, who is one of the authors, along with Gloria Taylor Brown, of Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, The Initiatory Path of Spiritual Journeying. This book details the journey of a group of people, including the authors, through Egypt and I think along the Nile, and visiting different temples and different energies of those temples, and actually invoking the energy of the area. The Egypt was a great center of initiation, spiritual initiation, and even Jesus went through that initiatory path prior to his documented time back with the Bible. So it's a great tradition and one that is outlined very specifically in this book. So, Normandy, thank you very much for joining us. Would you like to give the audience a little bit of your background and how you became interested in Egypt?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. Well, I have written 11 books now, and at least half of them are about ancient Egypt because I have become fascinated with them. I started translating hieroglyphs when I was a young woman. And getting my master's degree, and it was just something that took hold of me, and I continued to be totally fascinated with the life of really a scribe who in ancient Egypt was not only a scribe or a writer, but a healer who was also a priest. And so this whole notion of language for a writer like myself, who began very early writing. I started writing at the age of 9. This whole enchilada, if you will, of healing and writing and priesthood was very fascinating to me. And so I began to study that. I studied hieroglyphs as a way to understand how to craft language as an expression of the spirit. And as a result of that, I have been leading trips to Egypt now since 1989. And I usually go now. I've stepped it up to twice a year and continue to write my books on Egypt. I have another one coming out in December this year. So that's a little bit about me.
So the different temples have different energies. And as you go through the path of the different temples, is there a pattern that occurs in terms of the initiation?
That's a really good question. And I think that the best way to approach it is, of course, I feel that there is a pattern to the initiations, that each particular temple activates a particular center within you. The ancient Egyptians really felt that the body itself was a temple. And so each temple on the ground resonates to like the heart chakra, or it resonates to sacral chakra, it resonates to third eye or crown. But the temples are different, so they don't necessarily go in an order.
Right.
They work, each temple works individually, and they also work with celestial energies because each temple is connected to a particular constellation or star and a group of energies that comes through that portal. You know, like when you go to Karnak December 21st and you witness sunrise, it comes straight through the gate, you know, right through the portal, all the way hits the back wall in the Holy of Holies, and it really energizes. You know, the light has returned. The gold in that room would then just light up. Now, a different temple, say the one at Abu Simbel, was aligned to a date in February, which turned out to be Ramses' birthday, so the sunlight would hit Ramses the Great on this particular day. I'm not fond of that temple, but that's just an example of how each temple worked differently.
I want to ask you a question. I was reading Zeta Talk last night, and in Zeta Talk was quite an interesting explanation of the Great Pyramid and perhaps a purpose of that that has just been recently discovered, and that would be that the liquid mercury that's being discovered in the temple, in the pyramids now, may have actually been, there might have been a pool of mercury within the Great Pyramid that then went up the little tiny passages, you know, that they've had robots go up. You know, they're very tiny. Mm-hmm. People can't get in them. And then what the Zetas are saying is that it actually was a, I guess, a warning when Planet X was coming in the Great Temple. This information just came out, so I'm not sure that you've seen it, but
no,
it's very interesting.
I don't know about that, but I would love to find out more about that. Yeah.
Well, if you'll just go to Zeta Talk, it's the most recent email that Nancy sent out, and they of course the discovery of the mercury is very recent. I don't know if you've heard about that. That's an actual discovery. In a couple of temples, they found liquid mercury. And mercury, what they're saying is then, and I don't really understand how it does it, but it has something to do with the mercury being in those little tunnels between the king's chamber and the queen's chamber and the outside. And then when there was certain celestial events having to do with the return of Planet X, which of course they needed to know about because they were, you know, they would have been affected a great deal by a pole shift. So so basically it was a warning, and you know, whether or not it will work again, I don't know, because things have changed. You know, we're at a different place in the sky and everything. It's a different, it's a whole different system, but it seems like that the liquid mercury may have been involved in predicting certain celestial events that might have needed to be predicted. And of course back then they didn't have the, you know, the telescopes and all the scientific stuff that we have now.
Right. Well, they had their own versions of it, I guess.
Well, I think that, I mean, sometimes these temples were versions of it. You know, they were actually...
Yes, they were.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
were. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, it does seem too far-fetched to think that they would spend a great deal of their energy looking up at the sky and trying to figure out what was going on. Because if you're, mm-hmm. you know, if you're in the desert at night, in ancient times, there's not a lot of light except for the starlight. And so anything that's happening up there becomes of the utmost importance and is documented, you know. So, and seeing it is you know, keeping the records of when this occurred and when this other thing occurred. And, you know, mm-hmm. you know, it's the basis of a lot of our astrology and astronomy comes right from Alexandria.
It does. That's true. Well, can you give the audience a little bit of an idea of the path that you all took on this journey and why you chose to go in the direction you did?
Okay. I wish I could say that it was it was for some very mystical reason. But part of it has to do with the direction that the boat goes in, whether it's going up or down the Nile.
Right.
And a lot of that, you know, is your company. But
right.
for me, I think when I do trips to Egypt, I would say the ideal for me is to begin in the lower part of Egypt, to begin mm-hmm. in actually Saqqara and Giza somewhat, but there's not a lot left there except for the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually start in Saqqara, where the beginning of the pyramid text, the oldest spiritual scripture in the world, is recorded, you know, right inside these walls. Mm-hmm. And I think that I like to start there. It's the biggest necropolis. It lasted the longest in Egypt, and it has a lot of information about the ancient initiations, ascension texts, the way to go, you know, up the ladder, you know, of consciousness, and to the ascended masters, and sort of download the divine plan, which was how they kept a culture going for 3,000 years, is that their high priests were shaman who did this. And right. For me, Saqqara is a great place to start, because there's a lot to see, and it really pokes you into the consciousness of it. And then I like to go, we'll explore, you know, the environs around Luxor. There are so many temples and things to see there. You could spend, 10 days alone and not see everything that there is to see in the Valley of the Kings and in Luxor. Then we get on the boat in Luxor and we go up the Nile. You know, that would take us all the way to the Temple of Isis in Aswan at the end. And that's probably Greco-Roman built. So, you know, you're looking at the difference between 2500 BC and then sort of during the Roman times around 300 BC. So that's quite a link.
And the Roman, can you speak a little bit about the Roman invasion of Egypt? Because isn't that really significant?
Well, I would say the main thing that happened is that over a period of time, we'll have to kind of go back, over periods of time, the Egyptian culture, you know, if it did not have a strong presence that was kind of guiding the whole thing, it would fall. And there were what are called intermediate periods where there was a lot of confusion and invasions and people quickly, you know, trying to ascend to the throne. And there was a lot of backstabbing, political backstabbing. So certain pharaohs, you know, would just disappear.
Yeah, you had to be careful of your brothers and sisters killing you.
There was a pattern about that
for a while.
Right. And then, so anyway, the culture started out, it was much more, I would feel, the old kingdom I'm closest to, is much more spiritually aligned to, you know, what I think is the Atlantean period, or even what we're thinking about now in terms of a global spiritual community. But then, you know, in the New Kingdom, you get people like Ramses who are really strong, but they're also like conquerors in a way. And so then you have, you know, cultures that come in, like the Hyksos came in and they conquered Egypt because they had chariots and horses and so on. So toward the end, I would say, around 300 BC, the Greeks were close enough to Egypt. It was Alexander the Great came in and married Cleopatra, you know, and so it was kind of the downfall of native rulers, native Egyptian rulers, but he aligned himself with the old Egyptian philosophy. And so the Greeks were, they were more gentle than the Romans were. They tried to honor the divine beings. They did their best, but they didn't quite have it all together. You know, they, by that time, you know, even at the end of the old period, Egyptian people were looking at the Great Pyramids and say, gee, we don't know how to build those anymore. So you can imagine how the culture had evolved by that time. They just, you know, took over and they were more,
I wanted to mention something that not a lot of people know. Do you know the meaning of decimate?
Oh, this is going to be good. No, tell me.
Well, in Rome, if, you know, the Caesar or whoever the ruler was sent you off to battle and you lost the battle, they would line up all the soldiers and kill every tenth one as a motivator. Decimate.
A decimal. Oh,
now,
my
gosh. That is how brutal the Romans were. I mean, that says it all. You know, you're going to punish your own troops. So, you know, that's an historical fact. So that tells you. And then, of course, the Greeks weren't like that at all. They had much more philosophy, science, spirituality. They would not do that. So, but yeah, so that's just a little example of the differences in culture.
Yeah.
Rule by fear.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to talking about the spiritual traditions that probably were in the Old Kingdom. When exactly did the rulers quit worshiping multiple gods and then just worshiped one god, the sun god? When was that?
Well, the one sun god came with Akhenaten, and that's in the 18th dynasty, and that's a new kingdom phenomenon.
Okay.
So, all right, so that's like, you know, older, and then what follows from there is Ramses and so on. But the worship of, let's see, a polytheistic culture, and what I think of it as is that each particular city-state, wherever they were, had one divine being that was in charge of creation in their particular area, you know. One creator god made, you know, had a cosmic soup and stirred this cosmic soup, and chains of DNA began. And it's kind of like, so this philosophical system was much more like a chemistry and a scientific mathematical way of looking at creation. And that, you know, became the Greek god Hermes. But the ancient Egyptians called him Zehute or Thoth is another name for him. But there's another creator god who makes people out of clay, and he puts the clay on the potter's wheel, and he, you know, spins the wheel and molds the person in their ba, or their soul, or, and their ka, and their spirit. And so he's in Aswan. So Thoth is down in Hermopolis, which is lower Egypt, and Khnum is up in Aswan, which is upper Egypt. And it makes sense that he's there, because that's where the Nile floods and leaves all the mud on the banks at the cataract on the island of Elephantine. So it sounds like we have, you know, and there are many more other creator gods, I should, and goddesses. But it sounds like there's multiple gods. But, you know, if you look in the Bible, there are multiple ways of creating the world, even in the Jewish stories of how the world came into being. And yet we believe that that's monotheistic, but there's Elohim and there's Yahweh and, you know, so.
Well, these were probably, these creator gods were probably extraterrestrial, as far as we can tell. I mean, they were most likely, like, the gods in Egypt with the heads shaped with the points, you know, the different skulls. Those skulls have actually been found. I mean, those are probably Anunnaki skulls. So,
well,
you know, there.
Yeah, it's possible that there are other genetic influences in those particular beings that we're looking at. You know, Akhenaten was very unusually shaped. You know.
Yeah. But that might very well be extraterrestrial, though, when they. There was a, this also something I saw yesterday. You can probably Google it and take a look at it. There's something going on around on the internet about photographs that were evidently hacked out of NASA's computer. And like there's three or four pictures of giant beings. I mean, the skull of this being is probably the size of, you know, it's probably 4 feet or 3 feet just for the skull. So these beings are 12 to 17 feet tall, and their bones are there. It's evacuation sites supposedly on NASA's computer. So these beings of course, regular archaeology has hidden all this, but these beings have been found, and it's just that the powers that be don't want this information out. So these gods may have been very large people that were not originally from Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very possible.
Yeah, and there's so much that goes back to the culture of the Atlanteans, and there are a lot of stories that would lead one to believe that Egypt was civilized by these Atlanteans who were fleeing, you know, the sinking.
Right.
There's a lot of information about the melting of the polar ice caps that created the Great Flood, you know, mm-hmm. that then caused a lot of these places to be underwater. And,
right.
It's interesting that you have South American vessels that are created in the same way that ancient Egyptian vessels were created. I mean, the culture that mm-hmm. created them was the same. And these can, you know, withstand ocean travel. You know, they found
right. They
found these boats in the middle of the desert behind Abydos. You know, it's about mm-hmm. 10 miles away from the Nile Ocean, and I don't know how far from the sea. It's in the middle of the desert. These are pre-dynastic boats with, scraped out oar locks where the oars have been, you know, used over and over, and you know, these are seagoing boats and that are found in the desert. So how did they get there, you know?
Well, the Atlanteans were great. I mean, they were known for their seafaring ways. I mean, they
right.
went all over the world, and they went, like you said, when there was one time when there was great cataclysm and Atlantis broke up into islands, and then later on there was a second cataclysm when they sank. So a lot of people in Atlantis were clairvoyant and knew that was coming. So they left, and part went to Egypt, part went to South America, probably other places as well, because they evidently could reach anywhere in the world with their boats. So they had great
right.
technology.
They did.
And then
did.
Atlantis disappeared. You know, it's probably part of it's under the ice in Antarctica, and part of it is underwater. But it's supposed mm-hmm. to be rising up again, according to Edgar Cayce. So, you know.
Well, have you read the book by Rose and Rand Flemmath called When the Sky Fell?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because it is about, it basically takes the map that Charles Hapgood had of the drawings of what Atlantis looked like on this map. It's an mm-hmm. ancient map that's based on the maps of Plato and so on.
Right.
And he compared it to the photography from a Landsat satellite that shows mm-hmm. the proportions of the continent of Antarctica, and that there are, you know, pathways that would look pretty much similar to what this
right.
map that Charles Hapgood showed. So, and then he goes into the whole theory of how the polar ice caps shifted, which caused, you know, great flooding. The pole shift that, you mm-hmm. know, pretty much sent the mastodons, you know, who were feasting on clovers and flowers.
And then they were frozen solid. That's right.
Right. So it's a wonderful book about that whole subject matter, and mm-hmm. very convincing, you know, with scientific data. This man's a librarian. It's very well researched. Mm-hmm. I recommend that to a lot of people.
So that probably was where, you know, the energy, spirituality, and the knowledge came from that established ancient Egypt probably did come from Atlantis, you know, just because they had to go somewhere. And the ones that got out of Atlantis were highly spiritual because they had heard that they needed to get out, and they acted on that knowledge.
Right.
So.
Right. And I think also, you know, Egypt was a melting pot. So you have those people mm-hmm. coming in, and you have, like, the ancient Dogons. You know, the Dogon culture has been watching Sirius for a really long time and
right.
knew well before we did that it was a double planet. Yeah, they have a lot of connection to the ancient Egyptian traditions. You know, Sirius is the rising of the star is what causes the floods, you know, mm-hmm. or is the marker, I should say, doesn't cause the flood,
right.
the marker
yeah.
that the flood will begin in Egypt and that the land will be renewed. And so that mm-hmm. that planet was very, very important, and they knew all about this planet, saying that they were taught it, you know, by those who came
yeah.
to see them.
So what do you know about Jesus's time going through the Egyptian initiation path? Was that talked about in Egypt, or is there any information on that?
Well, what I know and what I have read may be two different things.
Well, that's okay. I'm more interested in what you know.
The one thing that totally fascinates me is that you can walk into Cairo now and walk down a city street, and there's on the same street there's an ancient synagogue and a Coptic Christian church and a mosque, and that the three mm-hmm. great religions are like all in this one spot. And I remember going into this very beautiful church. And it was entirely, a lot of these three places are built around where there's like a natural spring.
Mm-hmm.
And so the synagogue is said to be where the royal princess found Moses, you know, floating in the Nile,
right. yeah.
you know, and
yeah.
from the spring. And it was built on this spot. And right around it is this Christian church that has the natural healing spring waters flowing mm-hmm. all the way around this church, like a moat in every single
wow.
corner. The church is built around it, and then the mm-hmm. moat is inside the confines of the church. And there are all these beautiful chapels there. And there's one place I went that had kind of a grotto under the ground, which was said to be the place that Mary, Moses, and Jesus hid when they were in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And so it's considered a great healing chapel. There's frescoes on it. There's many people come down mm-hmm. to visit this place and, you know, receive the healing that's in this particular part of the building. I know from looking at the myths of Isis and Horus and looking at the biblical stories of Mary and Jesus, that the similarity is there. The temple walls are filled with images of the Queen Mother immaculately conceiving the Holy Child that then becomes the next Pharaoh. This is like the story that mm-hmm. Is part and parcel of how one becomes the next king of Egypt. You're immaculately conceived. The god Amun,
right.
the hidden god, comes and you know, has a relationship with the mother, who then gives birth to this future child.
Right.
And it's interesting because I read the hieroglyphs, and you look on the wall, and there's a conversation that's happening between Amun and the Queen Mother, and he calls her beloved. And when you translate that mm-hmm. word beloved, it's M-E-R-Y, Mary.
Really?
Yeah, so beloved in ancient Egypt means Mary. It means to be like it's written with the symbol of a plow, you know, which is like mm-hmm. to open a field and to insert the seed inside the field. That it's like that word comes from that.
Yeah.
So it's a beloved conjunctio.
Well, even in the Bible it said, you know, the sons of God looked upon the daughters of men and found them fair. So this
uh-huh.
idea of the gods impregnating humans and then the offspring being these half-divine beings who had, you know, more spiritual clairvoyance and ability to, you know, to lead, then became the kings and the leaders.
Right. Right. And so it wasn't ever, you know, it was unusual when Hatshepsut took over as pharaoh, because it was believed that, you know, the energy was transmitted through the female. The true divinity came through the queen, not through the king.
Right. Interesting. But I think what's more interesting than anything else is how, you know, a race of people not of this planet, like the Anunnaki, would be biologically compatible with humans, you know, who are very, very different, and able to have children. I mean, if you think of that, then the whole idea that there may be a frequency of life that is spread throughout many, many, many planets and even many dimensions,
well,
you know.
Yeah, and I'm not thinking that perhaps they didn't have the talents that we have now for certain changing of the DNA, you know. I mean, we can clone humans and animals now if we'd like.
The Anunnaki could too, though. Did you ever read any of Michael Tellinger's work?
I didn't.
Well, he's discovered, he's in South Africa, he discovered several million gold mines. The Anunnaki came here in order to mine gold, because when Planet X goes by the sun, they need to put gold in the atmosphere, or otherwise they can get too hot, you know, because they're not used to being that close to the sun. So originally the Anunnaki came here, and especially to South Africa, to mine gold. And then there was a point called Adam's something or another. It's like Adam's birthplace, where the genetic engineering of the first humans occurred. So they took human erectus, or, you know, hominis erectus, added Anunnaki DNA, and actually the children had to be in the womb. They weren't cloned like, you know, maybe.
No, I'm not saying like Petri dish, but I am saying that it's possible to adapt your, I mean, if you're coming from another planet and another completely different culture to mine gold, you probably have the capability to manipulate scientifically.
Absolutely.
Atoms and DNA to make
we
it compatible.
Do. I mean, you're right.
Yeah,
I mean, we do right now. I know, because my cousin is a very famous geneticist. We have the technology right now to clone humans, and we even have the technology to make dinosaurs. Did you know that?
Yes.
The DNA is an amber for dinosaurs, and we can make a dinosaur now. That is technically possible. And I mean, I wouldn't have believed it, but my cousin is actually in. You know, he's one of the mitochondrial geneticists who actually knows that this can be done. But in any case, so you're right. If they have the technology to travel from Planet X to here, they have the technology to clone or to mix genetic material.
And right.
I think that did happen. I mean, according to Michael Tellinger, that there's a huge amount of physical evidence that they were here. So, at least in South Africa. They were probably other places on the planet, too. But, I mean, the stories of, you know, Zachariah Sitchin would, if they're to be believed because of the, you know, the evidence in the scrolls and in the cuneiform, you know, the stone history.
Right.
That they were widespread on the planet, because they were trying to survive by getting as much gold as they could. But then they left. I mean, they left later on. So, but anyway, that's where probably the most of the Norse gods, Greek gods, Roman gods, gods of Hindus, and the Egyptian gods were based on, were different groups. It might not have just been Anunnaki, but different groups that had really, really advanced knowledge. And I think the best evidence is the skull-shaped in Egypt. The skull shaped of some of the leaders is not a human skull. It just isn't.
Well, that's also true. And if you look in the Mayan culture,
Right, exactly.
The skull shape, you know, they have very elongated skulls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of very heavy crowns that they wore, which only those type of skulls would have been able to accommodate.
That's a good point. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, and people even later on tried to manipulate baby skulls because it was so important in the society to have that type of skull to be respected, probably, you know.
Right. That's right.
There are cultures where they try to manipulate the shape of the skull, you know, early on where it can be shaped, which is, you know,
right.
just after birth, because obviously once it fuses, you can't shape anything. But it's
right.
very interesting. So, what is your new book on? You said you're going to have a book out soon?
Yeah. It's called The Union of Isis and Thoth, and it mm-hmm. is really about creating relationships with the divine beings, you know, because they're mm-hmm. not just, the gods and goddesses are not just those who have disappeared, but their energy still lives. They are divine beings. They weren't human and they died. You know what I'm saying?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So
they're still accessible.
So they're still accessible, and they still work with us all the time. And this book is about how to create a relationship that allows you to become a vessel for communication with the divine. Mm-hmm. That's primarily right. what it is. And why you would do it for, you know, primarily for the good of the planet, not for
right.
one's own
personal,
edification,
yeah.
but just for
right.
the good of the planet. You know, how do we contact, I guess what we would call the ascended masters in some traditions, the gods mm-hmm. or the goddesses, the divine spark itself, and let that move through us through a lifetime. And how do we honor it? And so we talk about initiations from the past. Mm-hmm. We talk about building etheric temples that they can mm-hmm. inhabit. Because everything that exists does not only exist on this plane, but it exists on three planes above us as well.
Yeah, in fact, there would be some who say, I think Edgar Cayce said, that nothing on this plane is a cause, it is an effect of higher energy. So
He's
you
right.
could probably say
That's
that,
right.
that
right.
this is the result of what's on the higher planes.
That's right. And and my understanding is that most things come into being through vibration. So whether
right.
that's a thought form, you know, color is a vibration, sound is a
mm-hmm.
vibration, thought is a vibration. Just the molecules in our body are vibrations. And so it's learning how to control the energies and the vibrations that are around us that help us to
right.
create that which we need.
That's very true.
Including ourselves. Yeah.
The teachings of Sai Baba are interesting. Sai Baba said that if you could concentrate on anything for 33 seconds, you could manifest it. Of course, the trick is really concentrating. Like he could,
yeah,
because he could manifest
anything. And you
anything.
Really blow it when you look at your watch and go, "Damn, it was only 31."
That's right. So it's not in your hand. But you know, he manifested things like a cross made out of wood, and when they carbon dated it, it was at the same time as the crucifixion. You know, very very mm-hmm. interesting, very interesting stuff he was manifesting. And I have several friends that actually met him, and they one person had a ring. He made him a ring. You know, he opened up his palm, and there's a ring, and he put it on. It was a little too big, so Sai Baba took it back, and he blew on it, and he put it on, and it was perfectly fitting.
All right, that's great. Well, there
really
are
is.
People here in the community where I live. I live in a spiritualist community, and most
uh-huh.
of the people here are mediums, yes, and they...
Yeah.
in the old times, they would create apports that spirit would create some object from the ethers and manifest it. It would come through a trumpet, you know, and kind of plop in the floor in front of you. And spirit can do all that kind of stuff. We are losing that ability because we don't. We sit around and we watch Dancing with the Stars instead of
working on it. That's true. There's still probably plenty of people who are guided to the spiritual path. You know, I think I've never seen Dancing with the Stars, so you know, it just isn't something I'm interested in. Anyway, we're coming up on the end of our hour. I want to thank you very much for joining us. Would you like to give your contact information?
Sure. If you're interested in going with me on trips to Egypt, you can contact me through my website at www.normandyellis.com. And it's N-O-R-M-A-N-D-I-E-L-L-I-S. You can email me at ellisisis@gmail.com. And I have lots of books for sale on ancient Egypt as well. You can find them on Amazon, or you can go to Hathor's Mirror, which is at shamanicjourneys.com.
Mm-hmm. And you're the author of Awakening Osiris as well.
It's Awakening Osiris, Dreams of Isis, Imagining the World into Existence, Feast of Light, and then Invoking the Scribes, and then this upcoming book.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been delightful talking to you. And go take a look at the information that just came out on Mercury being in those pathways.
That's
fascinating.
Very interesting.
Yeah, because we're coming up now, within the next few years, we're probably going to have this return of Planet X, with the pole shift global coastal event, and those who are interested know that this is a very, very important time for spiritual awakening because of this event.
Right.
So pay attention and quit watching so much TV and meditate more. How's that for advice?
That's what we're telling people. Quit watching so much TV.
There you go. Okay, well, take care. We've been talking with Normandy Ellis, who's a co-author on Invoking the Scribes of Ancient Egypt, A Fascinating Journey Through Egypt, which is one of the most important spiritual initiation points on our planet. Thank you very much.
You had plastic surgery, Bill?
You bet I did. I got tired of the wrinkles around my eyes and decided to have Plasticos do something about them.
But I didn't think men had plastic surgery.
Get with it, Bob. Men want to look their best, too. There's nothing wrong with getting a little help from Plasticos to look on top of your game. A lot of guys are doing it, my friend.
Well, I don't know about this.
Look, you see the difference Plasticos made with me. I look better and I feel better. My Plasticos surgery was an investment in me.
So where is Plasticos?
Plasticos is in Dunwoody. Plasticos is staffed by pros who guarantee you personal attention. The Plasticos number is 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available. 770-457-4677.
Headaches, back pain, migraines, joint pain, nothing worse than the nagging, unending discomfort of daily aches and pains. If you have pain and are looking for more natural solutions to eliminate your pain, Millennium Healthcare is for you. Millennium Healthcare's professionals will work for you. For help or more information on natural pain relief, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012. Millennium Healthcare. Pain relief naturally.
Please join us every Saturday morning for Temple of Health Radio Show, brought to you by Plasticos and Millennium Healthcare. Our holistic medical practices in Atlanta are committed to community education. Our shows bring you national authors on topics of health alternatives, new scientific breakthroughs, and spiritual medicine.
This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and I have with me Dr. Michael Rice, who is going to be in Marietta, Georgia, at Unity North Atlanta, beginning Sunday, May 17th, tomorrow, through Saturday, May 23rd. So, Michael, you want to tell the listening audience a little bit about what your week will be like up at Unity North Atlanta?
Sure, that would be awesome. And, of course, as you're aware, when we travel, we always do our travel workshops free. And so we'll be at Unity North starting on Sunday afternoon doing the first century Aramaic forgiveness workshop entitled Why Is This Happening to Me Again? From 2:30 to 6:30. And then on Monday evening, we're going to do a lesson from A Course in Miracles called What is the World? I think one of the most important and most misunderstood lessons in Course in Miracles, something that I've been working with for the last almost 30 years. And then on Tuesday night, 7 to 9:30, Monday night is 7 to 9:30, and Tuesday night we'll be doing On Creating Consciously. We'll look at the fact that we are by nature creators, and that we either create consciously or we create unconsciously. And as we become more aware, we tend to bring things to us that we want rather than the unconscious dynamic of wondering why this is happening to us again. And then on Wednesday night, 7 to 9:30, we'll do healing through relationships, and that's sort of graduate work on relationships. And then communication. Did you hear what I think I said on Thursday night from 7 to 9:30? Friday night, postgraduate work on relationships, codependence to interdependence. And then Saturday, the one workshop that we charge a fee for is on Saturday. It's an all-day workshop. It will start at 8 in the morning, go through till sometime between 5 and 6 in the evening. And it's entitled Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing. That's the only one there's a fee for. Otherwise, it's free, wide open. And what we're looking at is the whole first century Aramaic idea of forgiveness, which is exactly the opposite of what we're taught in this culture. We're taught a Greek idea today that forgiveness is about how you did something terrible, but I'm going to be a good guy. I'm going to let you off the hook for the terrible thing you've done that caused all this pain inside of me. Of course, I've been through this pain 87 different times with 42 different people. It's got nothing to do with you. It's about the content of my own mind. And in the first century, you'd never be invited to forgive another. You'd never be invited to forgive yourself. You'd be handed a tool with which you go inside yourself and remove the root of your pain, your suffering, your trauma, your drama, which is also the root of the energetic patterns that interfere with cellular function and cause our diseases. And so the opposite of what this culture teaches is what we'll be talking about around the technology of forgiveness. And there is a technology of forgiveness that has been suppressed and hidden for almost 2,000 years. And what I've studied and worked the last 35 years specifically, been developing and doing this work for about 45, but specifically been developing the understanding from the first century Aramaic for the last 35 years of how to literally change the content of the mind and recognize that when we look at a picture on the inside of our eyeballs, we're looking at a picture on the inside of our eyeballs. The world teaches us that we have a pair of windows and we look at what's happening out there in the world. And nothing could be further from the truth. There's lots of documentation coming out of the scientific world. Actually, there's a neat article that I discovered recently on the CIA's website, excuse me, where they're working on how do we get intelligence analysts to do the best job possible. And they literally say that perception, that we do not record reality, we generate reality. And each of us is generating our own reality all the time out of the contents of our minds. We're not looking at windows out there. We're looking at pictures generated by the interior process that's happening in our world. And that's why if people never learn to change what's happening on the interior, then they get to live the title of my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Because there's only so much content to play out. And every time a certain content is, you know, resonated into activity, we'll paint pictures of somebody who's the problem. And it doesn't matter whether it's our worst enemy or our best friend will do if we don't have anybody else to blame it on and it's up for us. And literally the step-by-step process of forgiveness is how to remove the capacity for disease, remove the capacity for pain, for hate, for fear, for rage, for guilt, and return to our true human lives. You know, one of the first questions that Jeannie, my wife, will ask when she opens the main workshop, why is this happening to me again, is she'll ask, how many have ever held a newborn? And in a single word, describe your newborn experience. And everybody's words are words based in love, purity, sweetness, mm-hmm. human life. And,
right.
you know, it doesn't matter what culture we've asked that question in, all over the globe, we get the same answer. It's always some variation on the theme of love, because everybody knows what human life is, what we are, and then we come into the world, and the world puts thumbprints on us, and we lose contact with the truth of who we are and buy into a rage-filled, pain-filled self that is mm-hmm. rampant with diseases, and we wonder why life isn't working well. Oh, in a nutshell, yeah. that would be my elevator speech these days, Susan.
And I also want to say, Michael, that, you know, we have had a cancer clinic here since 1999, and in the study of cancer, we find that there are cancer victims. The victim mentality is very, very common as a causative area of cancer. In other words, like breast cancer, if you're right-handed and you're you have someone who's supposed to be nurturing you and they betray you and hurt you and you become a victim, then you can get left-sided breast cancer. So this work you're doing is very, very important to get out of cancer mentality, because as long as you're in victim mentality, you have the ability to lower precipitously the energy of an organ and allow the cancer to start. It's not the only thing, but it is usually the emotional aspect that is with the first cancer. There's also electromagnetic, there's geopathic stress, there's radiation, toxic chemical, a lot of other things that can lower the energy. But in most patients, it's the emotional that lowers the energy first, being a victim.
Well, and in this work, we offer people the thought that there are actually no victims, only volunteers. And the qualities of energies that we engage in are what cause us mm-hmm. to volunteer for the game of victimhood. There's a neat quote right. from, cell biologist Bruce Lipton, where he says, mm-hmm. he talks about how when he had the insight into how the cell functioned and what activated genes and what turned genes on, was that he was delighted at his new job of being creator of his life instead of victim.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
on creating consciously is an important step in awakening and opening to that. So
it is. It is, really. And, you know, and I think that people just forgot what they're capable of. They just forgot that, I mean, we have a connection to the spiritual part of ourselves that is always there. And, I mean, it'll be there until you take your last breath. And then you can't not be in connection with your spiritual self if you're alive. But we just forgot, and we forgot what access and what great energy is available to us for creation. We just forgot who we were.
Well, I think that actually it's maybe even one step further and maybe a little more sinister. The world is set up by kings to make sure we don't remember. Because people who are conscious in their beingness as love won't go out and kill people and steal property for the king. They just won't do
right.
it. And
well,
so there's too. Been a system that's developed to make sure that the child that comes in is this purity of love, is knocked mm-hmm. unconscious and does forget. And then,
right.
of course, pain has a wonderful purpose. It makes our ears grow, and we get to start going, oh, yeah, I remember. Oh, yes, there is something else to life than this drama and trauma and insanity mm-hmm. that's going on in the world, for sure.
Right, right.
Susan,
well,
remind me
this...
what... Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, remind me of when you originally connected with this work and your story.
Well, I actually connected through Noetic Science. We all gathered and watched your video. You didn't have your book out yet. Why is this happening to me again? And at that time, it was, and still is, the best spiritual material I've ever seen in terms of understanding how we create and understanding the importance of letting go of things. Not because, as you said, you're not pardoning the other person. You're actually releasing an energy within yourself so that you don't live it over and over again. And then, if you remember, we met at Magic Mountain. Dr. Larry Dossey was there, but he got ill, and you took over. Teaching that weekend. But the funny thing was, we were sitting at the same table, and I was talking about being a trauma surgeon, saying that I never got the drunk driver, I always got the person the drunk driver hit, and we had to work on forgiveness. And then you said something, and I said, "You sound like Michael Rice," and you said, "I am Michael Rice." That was hilarious.
Small world, isn't it? Yeah, small world.
It really was, but I had already been introduced to your work, and then, of course, that weekend you did your workshop for us because Larry wasn't able to, and then you were on the radio show probably once a month for a long time. We had many discussions on the radio show.
Yeah, we may have to reestablish that, and I think, you know, tomorrow.
I think so.
You'll be really excited when you see what's developed and what we've come to understand in advancing that understanding of how forgiveness works and the technology. You know, back then I taught it because I saw that it worked, but I didn't know how it worked. Now I know how it works. Now I can explain it. In fact, we just had a student who's a professional trainer, and he creates professional PowerPoints. And he took 35 years of my study and learning on the core of the forgiveness process and put it into a 24-minute video PowerPoint presentation that's on our website. It's a YouTube video. So if people want to look at the core of the forgiveness process, they can go to whyagain.org, which is our website. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of the page, there's a bullseye, and people can click on the bullseye, and it will open a full set of instructions on how to start to engage in the technology of removal of what never belonged. And after doing this for the last 35 years, specifically with people, it always still just amazes me when people engage in that process, what they drop into, what they get in touch with, and what they're able to let go of is just monumental. It's monumental.
And then without those filters there, they quit attracting to themselves the same thing that again and again is causing their pain and suffering. It really
absolutely
releasing an energy within yourself that is so important. So, as you said, it's all an inside job.
So, right. Well, you know, I used to speak regularly at Global Sciences out in Colorado, and one year, Marcel Vogel, who was a 23-year senior scientist from IBM, showed up, and he had a camera called the Delaware camera that takes a picture of the high-energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. And what we're now showing people is that when something is resonating in us, you come along and you give me the look, and up comes my rage, and I paint a picture with the paintbrush of rage inside of me. That picture shows up on the inside of my eyeballs, and I actually think it's you. But what I'm doing energetically is spraying rage on you if I do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't generally get a really good response from people that you're spraying rage on. When I step into the main filter that's important, and if you go back to the Aramaic, when they said to Yeshua 2,000 years ago, what's the first law? I mean, the genius of this is just amazing. What's the first law? And he says, Rachma. And the meaning of that word had been lost until just a couple of decades ago when we rediscovered it in our laboratory. And that word is a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that sets the whole perceptual system in motion out of love. And when I start painting the pictures of the person who just gave me the look out of love, I spray love on them, and I get a different result, and it looks like it's miraculous. They changed. But, you know, when I'm not spraying hate and fear and guilt and acid on people, and I start spraying love on them energetically, they respond differently, as, of course, when I start spraying love on my own cellular structure, it responds differently and is able to heal. But as long as I carry that rage, that guilt, that fear of the generations, I'm continuously spraying that internally on my own cellular structure, which, of course, takes its toll and creates disease.
And very specifically, it's very interesting at, you know, like kidney cancer is about toxic relationships, nurturing out of divine, out of order creates breast cancer. you know, lying and certain particular practices can create brain cancer, but cell phones can also create brain cancer. So there's, you know, you can't just go on one thing. And, you know, it just, but it's very interesting. Everything, every emotion has a frequency, and that frequency affects your physical body, your emotional body, and your and on up into your mental body, because it affects your mental body. It affects what comes
all
next.
Energy.
Yeah.
It's all energy. And what predisposes us, what predisposes someone to be sensitive to the cell phone is what they're doing with their mind energy. It weakens the cell so that the negative influence or the factor of the cell phone can mm-hmm. become part of the creation of the disease process. When I strengthen the truth of who I am, and I'm continuously spraying into every cell of my body the truth of love, of being, mm-hmm. then I tend to be able to resist or refuse the influence of all of the other things that can precipitate disorder in the cell.
And I want to mention something important that I've learned that people may not be aware of. It is at night when you're out of your body that your body is most vulnerable. So turn off the Wi-Fi in the bedroom. If you're electrically, magnetically sensitive, turn off the breaker to the bedroom. Make sure you're not on a geopathic stress line. I had a conversation the other day with Burton Goldberg, who's the editor of Alternative Medicine magazine, and I said, Burton, I'm finding that 50% of women with breast cancer have geopathic stress. And he says, oh, no. He says it's more like 70%. And the only reason it's 50% in breast cancer is because there's a hormonal, you know, thing. The emotional and hormonal are also very important. Other cancers aren't hormonal, so you have a much higher... So for God's sake, make sure your bed isn't or your desk isn't on a geopathic stress line. I mean, that's something you can do very easily to, you know, to help yourself. But when your spirit is out of your body at night, you become much more sensitive to your electromagnetic disruptions. When you're conscious, you have a lot more protection. It's very interesting.
Yes. Yeah, placing the cell phone 12 inches from your head when you go to sleep at night on the table beside you is a big mistake, because that thing's continuously broadcasting and receiving information, even though it's not, you know, you're not on a call. It's continuously setting up that frequency, and really important stuff, really important.
And you can put it on airplane mode and avoid that. I mean, there is something you can do to help that pretty easily.
Or there's an inverse proportion to distance in terms of signal strength. So if you put it far enough away from you, you know, several feet away, then you don't have that influence at a level. These people that are going around, I see a new fad all over the place. And these people have Bluetooth hanging in their ear, continuously broadcasting, you know, a half an inch from the brain. And now they've got them hanging around their necks. So this broadcast unit is hanging right over the breasts, right over the heart, mm-hmm. right over the thyroid gland. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I've had one patient who was black, and black people don't get melanoma. It's very rare. And he told me that the mole right under the place where he kept his cell phone turned malignant. And then I had a woman who did a lot of consulting for her living, and she put the cell phone right on her chest wall, and she got lymphoma right behind it. I've had a number of people report things like this with cell phones. One woman got breast cancer because she used to tuck the cell phone in her left bra and wear it there, and she got a cancer right underneath the cell phone. So,
many,
you know,
do that.
I don't think these are random at all.
For sure.
You need to be careful.
Sure.
So why don't you give your contact information one more time and a little bit of information about the seminar in Atlanta and any other information you'd like to give?
Sure. Well, people can go to my website, whyagain.org. And you can download my book free in English, German, Russian, Spanish, Farsi. Part of it's there in Thai, French. There's several different languages. Mm-hmm. We've got over 5,000 pages on our website, so people can spend a lot of time finding every corner and every nugget that's there. There are videos, there are audios, there's written material. And, you know, I do a radio show now. I have been. We're into our fifth year now, an hour a day, 5 days a week, for people to call in and get support in using the tools. So we've now got a global community who tap into our radio show from 1 till 2 Eastern time, and most people just call in and say blog talk show. The archives, we've got over 1,000 hours of radio shows free on our site that people can tap into, mm-hmm. and they're all, not all labeled, but many of them are labeled with the topic that's involved. And if people have questions about this work, they can call in from 1 till 2 o'clock Eastern time, and the call-in number for our show is 646-200-4169. So the website, there's all kinds of information. We will be at Unity North in Atlanta, or Mayretta, as it's called locally. Mayretta. And we'll start on Sunday, and we'll have a full week of workshops free each evening, 7 to 9:30. We'll be doing the Sunday service. I believe it's at 11 o'clock in the morning. Pardon me? 11:15. And we'll be talking about the five Aramaic keys of Yeshua. What are the key principles that he taught 2,000 years ago in Aramaic for how to change the dynamics of the internal process of? Actually, you know something? I just realized that's actually in Asheville, North Carolina. We're doing David and Goliath, an internal battle. It's kind of a fun service that I'm going to do on Sunday morning. And then in the afternoon, we'll do Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And maybe if it's going to work out to get out there for it, maybe we can do dinner afterward.
That'd be great. I do want to mention to the audience that Michael is an expert in the Aramaic language, which is what Jesus taught in, and that on his website you can also take a look at the direct Aramaic into English translation of the Beatitudes, which will give you an idea of what Jesus was teaching, which is quite different than what turns out to be like the third or fourth translation through Greek, Roman, Hebrew, whatever, and then finally into English. So this is very important work because this is very close to what the important forgiveness principles that were being taught 2,000 years ago that really were lost. We ended up with turn the other cheek, but there's just so much lost in between that a lot of people can't turn the other cheek. They don't understand it. So this is very important.
Well, there's a lot of technology in between. If Yeshua sat in most churches today in America, he'd say that's all Greek to me. And the Aramaic language is
that's right.
What clicked for me when I first touched into it, my background was in electronics with a side study in physics, and what clicked in my brain the first time I heard it and what attracted me, this is physics. This is not theology.
Yeah.
This is about physics. This is about physiology. This is about genetics. This is how energy systems work. It's an energy systems language. And when you go back to it, and it's interesting, the actual structure of the letters in Aramaic are based in 3D reflections of the turning of the atomic structure of different elements. It's actually based in the creation, which I think is one of the reasons why at least six of the world's major religions have come out of the Aramaic. And there are just so many ideas there that are so misunderstood. You know, the word sin is probably one of the biggest bugaboos in our culture. And in Aramaic, it's an archery term. When you fire at the bullseye, you fire at the target, and you miss the bullseye, the scorekeeper would yell sin. It simply meant you're off the mark. That's all it means. And when they said the wages of sin is death, they were saying if you put an energy into a cell, into an organ that doesn't belong there, and you do that often enough and long enough, it's going to break down. You get enough organs breaking down, you're going to die. It's just simple physiology. And to recognize that there are qualities of energies that belong in human form and qualities that don't. And sin kills. Energies that don't belong kill us. It's the only cause of death there is. And it's the hostility and fear that doesn't belong in a human form that's made to incarnate love that kills us. And so it's about undoing the history of that and the genetics of that and recognizing who we really are.
Yeah, well, that's really important work. It's actually the missing link of, logic. The without understanding these energy systems and without understanding how these different frequencies of emotion affect these energy systems, including our own physiology, we really don't understand how things work. We don't understand how disease occurs. We don't understand how, you know, relationships fall apart and countries go to war. And, you know, now we've got nuclear bombs all over the place that are being sold on the black market, for God's sake. I mean, these are things that have the potential to destroy parts of the planet, maybe all of the planet,
yes,
if we ended up
in
a real war with Russia again.
Right.
So these are not small things. These are very, very important principles that I think we're kind of in a race to understand them before we destroy the planet, either through war or through environmental toxicity that then leads to massive cancer rates like we're seeing. We need to win this one through the right frequencies.
And one of the most common comments that I get from people, especially people in the sciences that come and do my work, is everything I've always known I now understand. It's like it puts the puzzle, the edges around
together,
the puzzle, and gives
people
a picture to start to put the pieces in that they have and to expand their understanding of how the whole thing works. And the whole thing works by law, and interestingly enough, in Aramaic, well, kings teach us that law is the rule of a superior, and they've got the big gun, and you better do what you're told, because if you break my law, you're in trouble. In Aramaic, there's no such thing as a superior who's insisting or requesting we do anything. Law is just a description of how something happens. And when you understand how it happens and you stay in harmony with it, things go pretty well. And when you don't understand how it happens, then in the avoidable collision with law, people are hurt. But law is never broken. Things are going to happen the way they happen because that's the way the universe is set up. And we don't have any choice about that, no matter how willful we are. You know, the law of gravity doesn't care whether you step off the cliff or not, but something's going to happen. It's just how it works, how it happens. And the person who designs and...
I'm sorry,
say
go
again?
Ahead. Oh, I was just going to say that train that tried to go around that curve at 100 miles an hour and derailed, you can't break that law.
Yep. No law, no punisher that says, I'm going to knock that train off the tracks. It's just how it works.
A law, that's right.
Yeah, and from the Aramaic, when you understand how it all works, it all makes sense. And all of these collisions, whether it's relationship or financial or health or whatever that we have, are avoidable when we understand how it works. And that's the simplicity.
Right.
We do we've got a whole course we've developed, a 16-day course called Laws of Living, that we've taught in the prison system, and we've cut recidivism by over 90%.
That's fabulous.
When 90% of the jail cells were empty, the sheriff kicked it out because he was out of business. He didn't have enough money to pay his bills because he gets a per diem from the state. We need to start to change things at their root.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Awesome.
And I'm really happy we were able to get you on air to let Atlanta know that you're in town.
Awesome. Delighted. I'm glad you made the move to make contact when you got our email and get it set up.
Sure.
And let's plan on dinner tomorrow night after the workshop, and maybe we'll do a full show next week if that works.
Okay. Well, take care, Michael.
All right.
I'll see you tomorrow. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.